Welcome to the Duke University Philosophy, Politics, and Economics Lecture Series for 2011. I'm Michael Munger, Director of the PPE program at Duke. This series is made possible by the generous support of Duke University, the Thomas W. Smith Foundation, and the Charles G. Koch Foundation. These speeches are in the public domain, but any use of this material must clearly identify the source, as both the name and affiliation of the particular speaker, as well as the Duke PPE program. We hope that you enjoy these lectures as much as the audiences did.
Today, we appreciate your attending this first of the PPE lectures for fall 2011. This is Dr. John Lewis, who is a visiting professor in philosophy, politics, and economics here at Duke. 2001 PhD in classics from the University of Cambridge. His dissertation was entitled Solon's Polis as Cosmos, Intellectual, Moral, and Political Integration in Archaic Athens. His most recent book was Princeton University Press, 2010. Nothing Less Than Victory, Decisive Wars, and the Lessons of History. And he's going to talk to us today about value and exchange in the ancient world. Dr. Lewis.
Thanks very much. I should have put a chocolate on every seat. Thanks all for coming. And I'm very happy to be here. To be here in the wider sense of being at Duke and to be here right now. My topic for today is the morality of exchange in ancient Greece and Rome. And I want to begin by narrowing the topic a bit. Obviously, one could not do everything about this topic in 1 hour lecture, and it would be a mistake to try. I couldn't speak that quickly, and you couldn't hear that quickly. So what I want to do is differentiate two questions, one of which I'm going to deal with and one of which I'm not. In thinking about the morality of exchange in the ancient world, I'm first off going to limit the ancient world to ancient Greece and Rome, and you'll see that I will dominantly be speaking about the Greeks. Just a very few things to say about Rome at the end. In trying to lay out a lecture like this, there's no limit to the amount of material that's available. The serious challenge is to bring it within limits to where it's comprehensible within an hour. And part of what I'm doing on that is largely limiting it to the Greeks. Please don't take anything by that to imply by me that there was an exchange or morality before the Greeks or after the Romans. It just happens to be where my topic is taking me today. We have to differentiate our evaluations of markets and exchange in the ancient world. That particular question, right? How would we evaluate morally exchange and markets in the ancient world? From a separate question, which would be, what did the ancients themselves think about markets and exchange in the ancient world from a moral perspective? See the two questions? If I were to consider the morality of exchange in the ancient world, I would need as much evidence as I could dig up about markets, about exchange in the ancient world, and I would need a moral standard from our own day with which to evaluate those activities. What I want to do instead is to consider what the Greeks and Romans, and again, dominantly the Greeks, themselves thought about the morality of exchange in the ancient world. All right, you see how there are two questions here? So rather, my concern here is, what did the Greeks themselves think and say about exchange in the ancient world, about markets in the ancient world, from a moral perspective? And then we can, outside of this lecture or in other lectures, evaluate what they thought about those markets and then deepen our understanding. So my major concern today is, what did major Greeks in the ancient world say, and in particular write, about the morality of exchange in their world? And we can note that Greek markets, I will bring up one thing about them, which is important, which is that their markets were raucous, rowdy, loud, not necessarily honest, a place where you could go and where the phrase caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, most certainly applied. So when we get evidence from these markets and evidence about these markets, we have to be careful about assuming that what we're hearing and what we're reading about is necessarily true up front. Like anyone else, if you went to one of these markets, you were trying to sell something, you were trying to sell it. No? And that means, at best, accentuating the positive and forgetting to mention the negative, and et cetera. And in many ways, we had a certain culture of exchange develop in ancient Greece. If you were a rich person and had slaves to do your bidding for you, you might send your slave to the market to do the buying and selling for you, et cetera. But what surviving authors tell us then is their perspective on the markets allows us to integrate their view of the markets with their broader thought per se. So, for example, we can read what Homer says about markets. It's very, very little, but he's got a couple of passages that deals with this. And more importantly, embedded within the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are activities of exchange that we can evaluate in order to try and understand what he thought about exchange. And one early distinction they began to make, and it's not an obvious one, it may be obvious to us, but it wasn't necessarily obvious to people in the past, is the difference between trading and looting. Between trading and looting. Trading is an exchange of values. Looting is taking something by force. And as we'll see, there were many people who recognized that in the ancient past of Greece and of Rome, there was a lot of looting going on. And in fact, it wasn't even necessarily a slur on one's character to say, oh yes, I'm a pirate. We have words from an ancient army commander who said, oh, when we go to fight, we don't depend upon getting resources, money, and food from back home. We get our money the honest way. We loot it. Right? Well, certainly you're in a different mindset from the modern world when you hear this kind of thing. And it's to the great credit of the Greeks and the Romans that they were able to break out of this and to distinguish this activity of looting from one of exchange, which is, of course, the first step towards some kind of moral understanding of human interactions more broadly and trading more narrowly. So let's think about an example from the literature and how this would apply. And I want to turn us to Homer's Iliad, book 18. There's an absolutely marvelous passage, one of the most astounding things from the ethics, from the epics, I think, as written. Achilles needs a new suit of armor. So the Greek god Hephaestus, who is the Greek equivalent to Vulcan in Roman mythology, the god of the forge, makes him a new set of armor. And in the process of doing this, he makes him a shield. So Achilles is being made, Hephaestus is making for Achilles a new shield. And on this shield is engraved in exquisite detail a complete world view. In fact, there's so much detail in the epics about what's on the shield that we know no shield could have contained all of this detail. But hey, it's a movie, right? It's a story. And on this shield is engraved a picture of two cities. Two cities. The city of war, or the city of war, better way to put it, the city of war and the city of peace. In the city of war, people lay in wait for shepherds who are tending their flocks. They jump out, ambush them, kill them, steal, and loot. That's not our concern today. Our concern is the city of peace. In the city of peace, we have a picture of a town in which there is much gaiety and merriment going on. There is a wedding taking place. Flute players are fluting. Dancers are dancing. People are celebrating. And in the midst of all this, a dispute breaks out in the market. A dispute breaks out in the city center. See, the city of peace is not a place where no one disputes. Oh, disputes rise. Disputes rise everywhere. It's what they do about the dispute that's important. So a dispute rises between two men. One of them has killed a relative of the other, and the other wants vengeance. And so dispute between the two rises, and sides start to form up. The supporters of this guy of the accused start to line up behind him, and the supporters of the one whose relative was killed line up behind him. The question of guilt is never really a question. We know the guy did it. The question is, how are they going to resolve the dispute between the two men? And some elders of the city are in the middle and are going to hear both sides and render judgment as what should be done to eliminate the source of disagreement. The goal here is to eliminate the source of disagreement so this doesn't spread into a blood feud, leading to further conflict and impact the possibility of complete social breakdown. And laying in the middle between the two disputants are two talents of gold, two bars of gold. And the gold is to be given to whichever of the elders brings out a good resolution to the dispute. So we have some of the wise men in town sitting in the middle, hearing both sides, and they're going to propose resolutions. Whichever resolution succeeds in ending the dispute, that elder will be given the two talents of gold. And notice how we have a merger here of what we could consider actually a dispute resolution or a court situation, if you'd like, criminal law, if you'd like, along with market activity, because these elders are to be rewarded. Whichever elder brings the good result is to be rewarded for his success in resolving the dispute. So right up front, the Greeks recognized this character of exchange could extend to many, many areas of human life. And in fact, there is always a quid pro quo. Some examples. No Greek ever knelt when he prayed. He stood when he prayed, and he offered to the god some kind of an offering, perhaps to burn the flesh of an ox in his honor and let the smoke waft up, or to pour a libation, to pour some wine onto the ground, and an offering to the god, always in return for the god doing something for him. There is always a position, a situation of reciprocity. At the very beginning of the Iliad, a priest of Hermes has a problem with the Greeks. He wants Apollo to throw his arrows at the Greeks. But in order to get him to do that, he has to appeal to Apollo by saying, how many times have I honored you? How many times have we had libations poured in your honor? How many times have we burnt sacrifices? And the Greek idea of a sacrifice, by the way, was to take an oxen or a cow or something, slaughter it, cook the prime steaks for yourself, and burn the fat for the god, right? That was his idea of a sacrifice. And he says, how many times have I done this for you? Now it is time for you to do something to me for me. All I want you to do is throw your arrows at the Greeks and slaughter them. One little thing. But you see, what's important here is that embedded in all of these actions is this idea of reciprocity. Now, we have another poet after Homer, a poet by the name of Hesiod. And if you've not read his Works and Days, I urge you to do that. This is the poet Hesiod, and his poem, The Works and Days. His poem, The Works and Days, is a manual about the nature of justice in an early Greek city and a guideline for how a farmer can live his life and be prosperous. And to be prosperous is the goal. He says things such as, don't go to the city and get involved in disputes with others. Don't involve yourself in court activity, in lawsuits, and etc., unless you have produced enough grain for an entire year and have stored it in your barn. So it's an elevation of productivity as connected to justice. And Hesiod says there are two strifes loosed in the world. Two strifes. One strife should be obvious to you, right? It's the strife of war and violent dispute. Some guy cuts you off on the highway when you're driving down the road and you just want to speed up and get ahead of him and give him a brake job. And, you know, if you're really out of control of yourself, which I hope you're not, you know, you want to jump out of the car and pummel this guy. This is the kind of strife that can arise between people. One of the strifes. But there is a second strife, he says. A second strife, which is a good strife. See, the first strife, the strife of disputing, is wholly bad. Nobody likes her, even though everybody gets involved with her. But the second strife is a good strife. It is the strife that leads one person to go into productive competition with others. In this kind of strife, potter vies with potter, meaning those who make pottery try to make better pottery than the other potter so they can get the business. Farmer vies with farmer, meaning trying to get as much grain in as you can so you can sell it and become prosperous. So there's a sense here again of a distinction between the violent strife of conflict and the benevolent, productive strife of competition. Astounding, given that Hesiod lived sometime before 600 BC, long before classical Athens was at its height, long before Plato and Aristotle. This rise, this distinction then, between the violent strife of warfare and the strife of competition was recognized by the historian Thucydides. And he writes from the very beginning of his history, in antiquity, quote, in antiquity, the Greeks and the barbarians who either lived along the mainland coast or in the islands turned to piracy as soon as they started crossing back and forth to one another in their ships, unquote. This activity of piracy was not necessarily looked upon badly. In fact, he says, if you saw a stranger in your town, you might go up to him and say, howdy, stranger, are you a pirate? No? And if he said, yes, well, watch yourself. And if he said no, then he is not. And Thucydides goes on to say, quote, the Athenians were the first to lay down their arms. And the actual Greek says, the Athenians were the first people to throw down the iron, meaning to stop walking around armed in their own city and to be able to deal with one another on a benevolent basis, on a peaceful basis. Think about it. We don't have to walk around armed as we walk around Duke campus. Think about the virtues of which Homer's heroes, which an Achilles would need on the battlefield, and ask yourself whether those virtues would serve you very well when you stand in the cafeteria line waiting for your food. It's not the way to go about things, is it? On the other hand, your virtues wouldn't serve him very well on the battlefield either. It is a measure of the accomplishment of the ancients that they're able to distinguish the two and to recognize that living a civilized life requires one to throw down the iron, to stop walking around armed, and to be able to deal with one another in terms of exchange of values rather than an exchange of force. Now, you might think, from what I've said so far, then, that Greek intellectuals would praise their markets and praise the activity of trade. But this is not the case. Major intellectuals saw big problems. Moralists saw big problems with the activity of exchange. Now, Greek moral thinkers, Plato and Aristotle being the most important, but certainly not the only ones, were largely virtue ethicists. The field of ethics in the modern day that they would be most closely connected to is virtue ethics. And virtue ethics is one in which the dominant concern is to figure out what the virtues are in a person's character, how they could express themselves, and to inculcate those virtues in young people. Virtue in men led men to lead virtuous lives. In fact, to have virtue, meant to act in a virtuous manner. It is not enough simply understand virtue. You're not virtuous if you just understand what honesty is, but don't follow it. To be an honest person, right, is to act in an honest manner. And so, virtue in men meant the action of being virtuous, and this led to virtuous cities and towns. If you have virtuous people living together and they act in a virtuous way, the Greeks would say, then their town is one in which justice, moderation, wisdom, courage when it's needed would abound. Many Greek intellectuals saw retail trade as detrimental to virtue. So let me point one out, one case where this really shows through. It is in a Greek writer by the name of Plutarch. How many of you guys have read any Plutarch? Oh, come on. Plutarch's Lives used to be canon at Harvard. Plutarch was a Greek, but he lived around 100 A.D. He wrote a series of lives of the illustrious Greeks and Romans. They're biographies, short biographies. And he wrote them in a comparative fashion. So he'd do one Greek, do one Roman, and then write an essay comparing the two. And he wrote a life of one Lycurgus of Sparta. His life of Lycurgus, L-Y-C-U-R-G-U-S. Lycurgus of Sparta was a myth historical figure from the deep past of Sparta who was credited with establishing the community of Sparta under laws, bringing Sparta its laws, bringing Sparta its customs, bringing Sparta its virtues, and therefore establishing the basic terms of interaction and the moral ideals for the Spartans. If you know anything about Spartan society, you know that it was that it was highly regimented, highly militaristic. When a child was born, the city elders would examine it and decided whether the child was healthy enough to be allowed to live. If it was not, it would be exposed on a mountain. If you were a young man, spend the first 18 years of your life in military training, and then from that point on, for the next 20 years, remain, for the rest of your life really, remain living in military barracks with other males, your entire focus of your life on military training. Who grew the food? People in the surrounding areas that the Spartans had subjugated, kind of an overclass. Plutarch praises Lycurgus for recognizing that one of the enemies, as it were, one of the threats to such a way of life is money. So he works. Lycurgus, the legend says, got rid of money in Sparta. You realize it becomes not important for us whether Lycurgus was an actual guy and actually did all this. What is supremely important is the later Greeks looked up to these ideals. And that tells us a lot about what they thought about exchange and markets. And Lycurgus is famous for having done away with the possession and trade of gold and silver and to have substituted iron for this. So if you want a loaf of bread, you have to bring a big clump of iron down to the store and trade it. Thinking that the possession and desire for gold and silver was a corruption, would lead to corruption in a person's mind and would undercut the social order. Of course it would. You had all kinds of people pursuing material values in this way and looking out for their own self-interest. They might fail to remember that they owed their duty to the city of Sparta, to the collective as a whole. And this would undercut Sparta. Now notice this idea that money is corrupting, and in particular, gold in particular must be banned, is directly reflected in Thomas More's Utopia. If you've ever read Thomas More's Utopia, especially the second book, the second half of it, where the island of Utopia is described, the use and trade of gold and silver is strictly forbidden on the idea that it corrupts one's soul, corrupts one's moral outlook to be engaged in such exchange. Many intellectuals following Lycurgus would take these ideas further and would say, well, you know, we should overall have fear of strangers. After all, you start exchanging with somebody you don't know, well, who are you going to buy things from? Foreigners come to town and bring foreign goods, which are exotic, strange, wonderful, valuable. And that too much interaction with strangers will also undercut the body politic. So he advocated a society that is strictly segregated from the rest of the world. Think about some of the communist countries where people are forbidden from traveling, or people were forbidden from traveling overseas on the idea that they might bring back bad influences. Think of the Soviet Union after World War II, shooting Russians who returned from the West after having been POWs for years because they might have been exposed to Western influences. So this idea passes down through history. It's connected, in other words, to a certain fear of strangers and to fear of strange things. In other words, there would be no markets for the citizens If you needed to buy something, send your slave down to the foreign market or send some intermediary to go down for you, and citizens were not allowed in the markets. Now Plato, philosopher Plato, takes many of these ideas and goes further with them. You know that Plato himself is an idealist and a dualist in his metaphysics. Not that he does duals, not D-U-E-L, but D-U-A-L. He thinks there is a duality in reality. That abstract concepts, ideas such as truth, justice, beauty, and most of all, the good, existed as it were, in a higher realm. It's difficult to get to what Plato really means by this higher realm. Is it a realm of pure thought, or is it an actual physical existence? I take it as metaphysical dualism, where he really thinks there is a higher realm of reality. And the goal of philosophy is to somehow get oneself in touch with that higher realm. See, you can't do it by looking through your eyes or through your senses, because your senses only deal with the lower, mundane, physical reality which we're all immersed in. And Plato goes at length to describe people who are caught up in the day-to-day affairs of this physical world and have no idea about the higher reaches of ideas. Well, given this rather dualism, this dualism between body and soul, or between matter and spirit, it's easy to perhaps speculate why he might then have thought that trade and markets were a debased secondary activity, and that philosophers and those who are enlightened by the higher realm should not engage in those activities. After all, when you're trading for something, if you go buy a car or a loaf of bread or a sandwich, you are trading some material thing for money. Even in a barter society, you're trading something for something. And this, he thought, anchored one, kept one too much bound to the world of physical reality and made it harder to understand and grasp the higher reality. And so when Plato lays out his scale of values, he places money and material goods as last. From his last work, The Laws, quote, "Once the pursuit of money should come last in the scale of value," unquote. So he thought that the pursuit of money, because it was the pursuit purely of a physical good, was a debased activity in comparison to pursuit of the more abstract concepts, truth, beauty, justice, the good, etc. Consequently, this reflects in the laws he puts forward, which he thinks would be proper for an ideal city. He thinks, for example, it should avoid bad influences on the city, by not putting the city too close to the sea. He thinks the city, an ideal city, should not be located on the sea. Why? Because this is good.
Because the sea would bring in strangers and people would look for strangers.
City is a means of interaction with the outside world. You've got all kinds of strangers coming in or bringing in these strange material goods. This will divert the best citizens from their contemplation of the good for the city in the abstract sense, and will further corrupt and undercut the worldview and the way of life which people are living with one another. And you can see again that this kind of thing is not inconsistent with xenophobia, fear of strangers, the idea that strangers bring in bad influences and should be avoided, something which we still see in many countries in the world today. He thought, for example, that in the markets, there should be no bargaining allowed. No bargaining should be allowed. He says right out, "No seller in the market must ever name two prices for his goods, but only one. And that price, Plato maintains, should be the proper price." Now, how does one determine what the proper price of a good is, absent supply and demand and the influence of a market? Well, Plato buys into what's known in economics as the doctrine of just price. Doctrine of just price. It's an idea. It appears in Aristotle again, and then further in the medievals, especially Thomas Aquinas and others, that every good has a certain proper price. See this water here, which I didn't know was unkept, so I succeeded in throwing all over everything. This water has a just proper price, which should be, let's say, 99 cents for a bottle. How do I know that that's just the proper price? I don't know. I just somehow intuit this is the proper price. Should I, in the market, set a price of $1.99 on this, then I'm setting a price too high with respect to the just price, and I should be forbidden from doing that. You might notice, go ahead.
Where is this doctrine of the just price at located? Is that in the Republic?
It is. It's implied in the Republic, but it's definitely in the laws. And the section is 917C, 917C. Specifically, what he says is that there should be only that a seller must not name two prices for a good, only one. But then he goes on to say how there should be overseers of the markets, market managers, who should make sure that people only set the proper price for their goods. And you can see this in the modern day. North Carolina has an anti-gouging law, something that Professor Munger has written about. And an idea that, let's say, the power goes out, and so Home Depot has got a bunch of generators for sale, and it jacks the price up on the generators, knowing that the need is higher, and that this is forbidden by law. Plato very much agrees that such activity should be controlled by the state. He actually says, quote from Plato's Laws 850, the detailed supervision of the market must naturally be in the hands of the market wardens. One of their jobs is to, quote, see that people are conducting their business in an orderly or disorderly fashion and to inflict punishment on anybody who needs it. Too much marketing, in other words, too much raucousness in the market means that the market wardens, who are functionaries of the state, officials of the state, have the right to bring fines and to bring punishments against those who might do this. And he goes on and on in some detail. On the first day of the month, the agents are allowed to do this. On the 10th day of the month, they're allowed to do this. Okay. The third market should be on the 20th when they hold the sale of livestock. He's got the calendar all laid out of when things are allowed to be sold, when things are not to be sold, and etc. And all this draws out of the idea that there's a certain proper price for things in the market, certain proper activity, and that the state should regulate that activity. In other words, the idea that the government should have control over markets is an ancient one indeed. And Plato also states in these same passages, this is all between, let's say, Plato's Laws 846 and 850 or so, Book 8 of the Laws, that that citizens should have separate markets from foreigners and from retailers. In Plato's world, you as a citizen, and the citizen is going to be a small number of the total population of the city, the true citizens would not be allowed to go to the malls on a Sunday afternoon. Because going to the mall leads you to forget, you know, your duties to the duties to the city, your duties to others. You get wrapped up in buying things and all this, Plato thinks, is rather detrimental. Now, for Plato, in other words, this is all connected to a certain conception of justice. And the conception of justice that Plato has is that justice is a certain harmony between people, a certain harmony between individuals. Justice, he says in the Republic, is a situation in which each person knows his position, each person knows his job, and each person sticks to that position and that job. The idea of social mobility is very, very rare indeed, if not completely missing. So if you're a leather worker and you deal in leather, that is your job, that is what you are to do, and that is what you are to stay doing. It is only by putting each person in his proper job and by having him stay in that job, then we can maintain kind of harmony in the city, says Plato, and avoid conflicts between people. Aristotle, Plato's student, has a somewhat different conception of justice. Let me back up and say one thing about Plato that I missed, I should have said. Plato's conception of justice as a harmony between people in the city directly reflects on his view of the soul, in which he thinks justice inside a man's soul is a harmony between the parts of the soul, a harmony between the rational part, the appetitive part, and the emotional part. And that a person who is just in mind is a person who has no conflicts within his soul. So Plato's conception of the soul directly reflects upon his conception of the city. Other thinkers would also expand that conception further and say, so it goes for the cosmos and the stars above our head, right? A certain harmony between them. Well, Aristotle has a different conception of justice. Aristotle sees justice as a moral virtue based on certain proportions. Justice is a moral virtue. Aristotle thinks that trade is certainly legitimate. He does not come down on it so heavily against it as Plato does. I should say, actually, to be more precise, Plato's not actually against trade. He just doesn't think the citizens should be doing it because they should be involved in a higher activity. Trade should be left to those at the bottom end of the social scale of Plato's social hierarchy. Aristotle doesn't have quite the same animus against trade. He thinks trade is legitimate. But there's a big but involved in that. We have a thing. I have a glass of water here. What value is this water? And the answer is the water has a value because it satisfies a need for me. A need right now to quench my throat. My voice is under great stress, so let me do this right now. Take my word for it. It is water, and not something else. If my lecture begins to deteriorate from this point on, you can think otherwise, but hopefully not. And it satisfies a need for me. I have a certain want. And in fact, if I go to the store, the people in the store need water too, right? But they sell it to me in exchange for money. Why would they do that? And the answer is they have more water than they need. They don't need any more water. What they do need is some money. So they exchange me the water, and I give them some money. And this is all perfectly legitimate. But notice that if I take this water and I use it as a means to get money, if I fill it back up with water, cap it, you know, and sell it to you for a dollar because you're parched, I've not used the water for its primary purpose. The primary purpose of water is to drink. This is what water is for. But if I trade the water to you for money, I'm using the water in a secondary sense, you see? It's a secondary use of the water. The water really has two uses. The primary use, which is to drink, and the secondary use, which is to exchange for money. Aristotle therefore thinks that the use of money leads to a secondary use of the things involved. Aristotle's own example is a shoe, if this is not clear. Let me try to make it clear this way. What's the proper purpose and purpose of a shoe? And it is to be worn. That's what a shoe is for. Every part of the design of a shoe and the manufacture of a shoe is to make it suitable to be worn. So if I take the shoe and I sell it to you for $10, I'm using the shoe in a secondary sense, you see? I'm not using it for the primary purpose of wearing it. I sell it to you, and then you wear it. Or you pile it up in the closet with the hundreds of other shoes you have, and one day your heirs dispose of it all. So exchange, in other words, is useful. It's important, but it's a secondary use of a thing, not the primary use. Therefore, Aristotle is, I think, forced into a position of recognizing that money itself as a medium of exchange involves the secondary use of goods and is not teleologically the highest activity associated with the good. See, to understand what Aristotle's saying, you have to know something of his teleology. Teleology is the science of ends, final causation. What is the purpose of something? And the final purpose of a shoe is to be worn, is not to be exchanged for money. In fact, if I sell you my shoes for $10, you can get $10 for them. The reason you buy them is so you can wear them. But suppose I sold you my shoes for $10 and you bought them for $10 because you knew you could sell them to somebody else for $20. Whether you bought the shoes for something other than its primary purpose, for the purpose of making money. And Aristotle's forced in the position of maintaining then that making money in this way is a secondary activity. In other words, money making itself is tainted by not being truly the proper use, the final use of a thing. Make sense? Why, by the way, do we have money? How does money work? And money, and Aristotle speculates that money is necessary to bring incommensurable things into proper measure. So suppose we're just in a barter situation. And I have some water here, and you're very parched, and you'd like my water, and you have a fancy pen, and you say to me, I'm willing to exchange the pen for the water. And I say, well, I could use a pen, I don't need the water. Okay, we exchange, right? What I've really said is that the pen is more valuable to me than the water, which is why I would exchange. And what you have said is the water is more valuable than the pen, which is why you exchange. So there's a certain commensurability then between the water and the pen. They're of equal value, even though our needs are differently, thus we exchange. Does that make sense? Well, what Aristotle observes is, what is commensurable about a glass of water versus a pen? What's the same about them that you can measure? There's nothing. Water is a liquid, a pen is a solid. Pen is to write with, water is to drink. Water needs to be contained in a thing, pen is separate. The manufacturers are completely different, the purposes are completely different, their characteristics are different, but the only thing they have in common is that they're solids and they're man-made. So how are they commensurable? They're not. Yet, the very practice of exchange indicates us that we judge that they are commensurable. How do we resolve this? And Aristotle says that money is the resolution to this. Money allows us to calculate the similarity between things. Now, you would notice, those schooled in logic would notice that there's an intense problem with that, too. Because if I say A and C are not equal. A is a pen and C is the water, right? They're not equal. What I've really said, if I put money in the middle, is that A equals B, B is money, right? A equals B, B equals C. But if I say A equals B and B equals C, what I've said is A equals C. What I've just said is restated with a little bit of a confusion that a pen equals water. So thinking of money this way does not resolve the conflict. And Aristotle does not really resolve this situation properly. Other thinkers, and I would leave you to study other economists in history to see how they resolve this, one resolution being, of course, utility. It's the usefulness of the water to you that leads you to want it, the usefulness of the pen to me, and to resolve the situation this way. But Aristotle himself never really resolved it. But we are left with the conclusion, in the end, that exchange using money is a secondary activity, that loaning money at interest, meaning a bank loans you $1,000 and wants a 5% interest over the next year as you pay it back, that the use of interest in this way is improper, so Aristotle ends up being opposed to usury. A problem that reflected through the medieval period, through Aquinas and others, and still reflects in laws today, such as Islamic laws, which are opposed to usury, I'm told by Islamic scholars, and that Islamic banks work to get around this by charging service fees and the like, etc. Because given this given these ideas, the lending of money at interest is a secondary use of money, not the primary, and Aristotle, it appears, simply could not grasp how if I loan you $100 and you give me back $110 at the end of the month, it is an advantageous to both of us. It just seems like I'm robbing you of $10. So the problem of usury is one that reflects through history and one of which I hope in future times you give some thought to and some reading to. One last Greek text, just to note, not all Greeks thought that exchange was a secondary activity or necessarily bad. In the 350s BC, at the same time as Aristotle, a Greek writer by the name of Xenophon wrote a short political pamphlet for Athens entitled The Ways and Means. The Ways and Means, it's also known as On Revenues. Here's the problem. The late 350s BC, Athens had gotten involved in another one of these terrible and unfortunate wars with some of its allies in the Aegean Sea. Many Athenians wanted to see Athens return to a position of preeminence and prestige among the Greeks, and they thought that the best way to do that was to create a new military navy, was to throw all kinds of money into military affairs, and to go out and exact tribute from the allies, in other words, to force them to toe the line. Problem was, when you tried to do that, the allies don't like it because they're Greeks. They're Greeks too. They rise up in revolt. You end up in a war, and all these marvelous ships that you just built end up at the bottom of the ocean, sometimes with their crews going along with them. In other words, war may be necessary at times, but it's no way to make money. And when Xenophon comes along and says, this whole approach is wrong. Whole approach is wrong. What you need to do is to build a new merchant navy and to spread trade and productivity across the Mediterranean. Abandon war and empire. Don't treat your allies in a hostile way. Instead of appropriating money to build a military navy, appropriate money to build a merchant navy. Instead of building spears and shields of which to attack your neighbors, invest the money into silver mining. Mine silver. Print stamp coins out of it and use the coins as exchange. Instead of treating your allies as hostile people to be subjugated or defeated in war and in battle, treat them as friends. Invite them to come to your port. Build houses. Build houses and hotels for them to stay in. Allow them to freehold land in Athens. In other words, he says, wealth is created, prosperity follows when people are allowed to trade openly, value for value, this way. And he's got a series of, I think, pretty astounding observations within this very short pamphlet. One of them, I'll just mention one. One of them is he has a certain nascent beginning, in other words, early conception of economic growth. He says, allow foreigners to come into the port city, allow them to start their activity. As they get trading, more and more people will come and trade, more and more goods will be exchanged, more and more stuff will be built, more and more needs will be answered, more and more allies will come to Athens, more and more silver will distribute throughout the world, and everybody gains. This is how Athens is to return to predominance and prestige. And I think that it's a fitting way to end the discussion of the Greeks to consider the very different outlook in this from the outlook we saw at the beginning. The outlook which too often was based upon war and upon seizing of values, and rather to consider the production of values and the exchange of values. Xenophon is very much an anti-mercantilist. You guys familiar with mercantilism as an economic doctrine? The idea of state control over money and to limit exports of, usually to limit the export of precious metals, so that King Louis XIV wants to pile up all the gold and silver he can in his palace so he can use it to fund wars. And instead, Xenophon says, let the silver glow all over the world. Because when you exchange for something, you're getting something back for it, makes everybody richer. Let the silver glow throughout the Greek world. Now, let me say, just in the last five, ten minutes or so, say something about the Romans. Since it was billed as Greeks and Romans, I don't want to shortchange you. And think about the Greeks for a second. They lived in their individual city-states. During the period of classical Greece, it's an astounding fact to consider. Politically speaking, there was no Greece. There was no nation called Greece. There was only the city of Athens, the city of Sparta, the city of Corinth, smaller cities, the city of Plataea, the city of Orchomenos, etc., etc. Individual Greeks lived in their individual city-states, each of which set its own laws, determined its own policy. They were not part of any greater state, not when they were self-ruled in the classical period. You end up with all kinds of petty anti-conflicts when you do this, as if I stood before you and had to demand that we all stand up, rise up, and oppose those vicious enemies that are attacking us and threatening our way of life. Those people from Hillsborough. Right? Suddenly that's the scale at which they're on. Well, the Romans, as they set out to spread an empire throughout the world, were faced with an entirely different set of problems. They had to figure out how to rule basically the entire known world from Rome. How is it that I can respect the laws, let's say, of the city of Athens, not disrupt their laws so much that they go into revolt, but on the other hand, bring them into the wider orbit of Roman law and Roman civilization? You see the problem. And this led many philosophers, and I'll talk for a moment about Cicero, one of the most famous, to consider this problem. They considered, in other words, the nature of the organization and relationships within a particular city, and then looked to apply that across an empire of thousands of square miles. A problem the Greeks never had, you see. So, how do we integrate trade with this political rule? In order to do that, something like Cicero says, we have to integrate trade and understand economics and law in its moral context. How do I understand what is right and wrong as applies to issues of sale and exchange and issues of law? And so Cicero, drawing upon Roman law, which was pretty at its early stage when he lived in the first century BC, but was greatly developed as time passed, ask questions such as this. Suppose I've got a house, and I know that this house has got rotting timbers inside its walls and is about to fall down. Well, obviously, what I want to do is sell the house as quickly as I can and get away, get the money, and get out of town. Well, it's not obvious, but many people would want to do that. So Cicero asked the question, if I put the house up for sale and I sell you the house, you come and you give me the money, either directly or through a mortgage, and I leave, and the next 6 months from now or a year from now, the house falls down, have I done anything wrong? You get the question? Have I done anything wrong if I conceal a defect in a good that I'm selling? How many of you would say, yes, I have? And how many people would say, no, in the end, not looked at legally, because it is up to the buyer to take more care? Anybody? Okay. Caveat emptor. Right answer. Let the buyer beware. The buyer should inspect the house, is the other argument. Notice that it's predominantly on the side here that I've actually done something wrong. And Cicero presents both views. Those who would say yes, that the seller has done something wrong, and those who would say no, he has not. And in the end, comes a conclusion that yes, he has done something wrong. He's done something morally wrong. And there is no dichotomy, as it were, between moral right and wrong and legal right and wrong. If the law, properly enforced, would not allow me to hide something of that nature, because there'd be no meeting of the minds on what the house is, And besides, the house never would have sold if I put a big sign on the front that says, danger, about to fall down. And that's exactly the example that Cicero uses. So Cicero takes examples such as this and tries to integrate the activities of exchange as well as other activities in civic life with deeper moral thought, with the laws and regulations that might apply in a small particular city against those that would apply more broadly to the empire as a whole. And he comes to the conclusion that trade is, as a deep moral foundation, if properly conducted, trade is good. At one point he says the very purpose of the Roman government is to protect people's property from being taken. Trade is good, property is good, but you cannot divorce it from deeper moral conceptions, because by the very act of saying something is good, I'm connecting to a moral context. That's how we know what the good is, you see? So Stoic and Roman thinkers were very concerned with making these deeper and broader conceptions. Nevertheless, or perhaps unsurprisingly, the idea that trade is somehow tainted, or that traders are easily themselves tainted, stayed in Western civilization. Some basis for it, because some traders are, you know, dishonest, right? And move ahead some centuries to the dawn of the Christian era. Look at the Emperor Diocletian in the 290s AD. And he was faced with rising prices across the empire and ruinous inflation, which could destroy the life savings of people and make it impossible to buy the goods they need to live. What was the cause of the inflation? We know today that the dominant cause was over a century of imperial policy that consistently debased the coinage. You have 20 coins here, and they're made out of silver, right? And let's say the coins are worth, a dollar a piece in modern terms, right? 20 coins. So I'm the government. I call all the coins in. I mix in enough nickel into the coins so that I can now stamp 20 coins, 25 coins rather. Had 20, now I have 25 coins. Only the coins are debased with nickel, right? So I release them all, say they're worth a dollar. What happens? Too much money coming out in relation to the value, so the price of the money starts to fall, which means prices start to go up and you get inflation. So the next emperor comes along, recalls 25 coins, debases them with nickel some more, releases 30 coins, and calls them the same value, but of course, 30 coins are only worth what 20 coins used to be worth, so the price of goods goes up, and you end up with a ruinous inflation. By the time you get to around 300 AD, the actual precious metal value of the coins was about 4 to 5% of the whole. They debased these coins almost 20 times, when one coin became 20 over this time. The result was a ruinous price inflation. So Diocletian is faced with a problem. What is his solution to the problem? He put in place the first comprehensive wage and price controls, in which he demanded that merchants not raise their prices above the scheduled prices, which he released. See, there's that doctrine of just prices again, right? Everything has a just price. And wages would be paid according to this schedule of wages at the price of extreme punishment, should anybody break outside these scales. And the result was the inflation continued. Why? What was the root cause, said Diocletian, of the inflation? The greed and moral depravity of the traders. They're all out for such a quick buck that they're raising the prices more than they should be, and therefore the sanctions of the state have to fall down upon them in order to make them toe the line. When in fact, of course, the real reason was economic. It was the debasement of the coinage and other similar imperial policies which undercut the value of the coinage. A valuable lesson here, as you hear talk about the economic situation we're in today, probe more deeply into what you read. Don't accept the face value of the conclusions that you hear, and think more deeply about it. I want to give a final word to a Greek called Demosthenes the last 30 seconds, if you would, an orator, and he said this about a case he was trying involving fraud in the marketplace in Athens. Quote, "Besides this, men of Athens, you must not forget that while you are today deciding one case alone, you are fixing a law for the whole port, and that many of those engaged in overseas trade are standing here and watching to see how you decide this question. For if you hold that contracts and agreements between man and man are to be binding, lenders will be more willing to risk their money, and the business of your port will be increased. But if ship owners, after engaging in contracts to sail to Athens, are permitted to put their ships into other ports and break their contracts, there will be nothing to prevent the voiding of all contracts. And the result will be a collapse," he says, of our city and our means of dealing with one another. So I'll give Demosthenes the last word here. And thank you for coming. Thanks for inviting me.